Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Columbus rainfall in mid-May left the ground too saturated to absorb a record-smashing downfall last week that produced minor flooding along some waterways and near flood stages along others. Sewers overflowed, basements flooded, but at the same time, a central Michigan dam collapsed, forcing a mass evacuation and threatened a nearby chemical plant. Governor Gretchen Whitmer marveled at the intersection of disasters.
I think like everyone, right, it's hard to believe that we're in the midst of a 100-year crisis, a global pandemic, and that we're also dealing with a flooding event that looks to be the worst in 500 years.
Engineers and safety experts warn that changing weather patterns will continue to endanger U.S. infrastructure. New York Times reporter Henry Fountain specializes in the science of climate. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
The dam collapse in central Michigan, it hasn't been directly connected to climate change yet. So what caused the dam to fail? Just a lot of rain.
Yeah, a lot of rain, a particularly heavy two-day rainfall of about 5 inches, I think it was. And the main problem was before that, as you alluded to, same situation in Ohio, there was 4 or 5 days of pretty steady, not necessarily spectacular rain. So by the time this heavy rain came along, the ground was super saturated, and more of the heavy rain ran into the river and into the reservoir. And the other problem is that the dam itself was essentially unsafe. It's a 100-year-old dam. It had been cited for having inadequate spillways to handle excess water in the reservoir behind it. So combination of heavy rain, prolonged rain, and an unsafe dam.
But it's not alone in on those scores. The American Society of Civil Engineers, in its latest report card in 2017, gave the nation's dams a D grade. There are lots of others like it out there.
There's something like 91,000 dams in the United States, most of which are privately owned, as this one in Michigan was. Most of them are small. Most of them, if they failed, there wouldn't be much consequence. But a lot of them are bigger. The one in Michigan was 54 feet high. And so of the 91,000 dams, something like 20%, maybe 15 to 18,000 of them, are categorized as having high hazard potential, meaning that if they failed, they could cause loss of life.
I was surprised to learn that so many dams are privately owned.
Yeah, well, if you think about it, I mean, I don't know what it's like where you are, but I live in New Mexico, and, there's the big dams that everybody's heard of, like Hoover and Glen Canyon and things like that. And those are obviously, those are federal dams. But if you drive through ranch lands in New Mexico or farmlands in Ohio, you'll see oftentimes they're kind of hard to notice because maybe they're a couple feet high, maybe they're maximum 10 feet high, 15 feet high. But they're everywhere. They're usually made out of earth. Sometimes they're overgrown. But those are all on private land. They're privately owned.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And we are talking about warnings that changing weather patterns will affect everything from drinking water and power companies to bridges and highways. My guest is Henry Fountain. He covers the climate for The New York Times. And he wrote about the dam collapse in Midland, Michigan last week. We are going to be talking about this topic throughout the hour. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Regardless of what's causing the climate change, it is changing patterns now. The rains are getting heavier. We've certainly noticed it here in central Ohio, and obviously the same thing happened up in Michigan, and it's happening across the country, right?
It is, climate scientists and their computer models have long said that this will happen, and we're seeing it happening. It's as the climate warms, a couple things. One is warmer air can hold more moisture, so you expect heavier rains, and just the sort of extreme events where super heavy rains, sometimes accompanied by high winds, are expected to increase, and we're seeing that. As I wrote in the story. At this point, you can't say whether the rains of last week were really related to climate. There'll probably be a study, they call them attribution studies. There's teams of scientists around the world that do this, that kind of quickly come in and analyze a particular storm or a particular heat wave or whatever to try to determine if they see sort of the influence of climate change in the event. And that'll probably happen in this case. But as of now, no one can say for sure, but you can say for sure that extreme weather is increasing in most places around the world.
And we can say forgive my interruption, we can say for sure that whatever's out there that's been built, you know, 100 years ago wasn't built to withstand what's coming ahead.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Even now, a lot of infrastructure designers, and you can sort of understand this, that when they're looking at designing something safely, they look at past weather because that's what they have observations of. So they might look at 10 years or 20 years or 50 years of rainfall data, for instance, when they're designing a dam. But with climate change, because the climate is changing and weather patterns are changing, you have to try to look into the future. So that involves a kind of different way of looking at it, a different way of designing. That's just starting to catch on. But certainly 100 years ago, there was, you know, climate change wasn't a concern, wasn't even really a thought 100 years ago.
Right. And I get that. But I don't get, it's kind of hard to believe that the designers aren't thinking ahead to what might be 100 years from now.
Well, they're starting to. The state of California, for instance, passed a law that's saying any state project, with any state project for any kind of infrastructure, not just dams, climate change had to be taken into account. And there's, you know, obviously when people see events like what happened in Michigan, it convinces more and more people that, hey, we've got to, like, take this into account as we move forward.
The Trump administration has proposed that climate change would not need to be taken into account when assessing the environmental impacts of major infrastructure. Does that... That's for, I guess, for federal projects, but can it affect the efforts in California if there's federal and state funds mixed in?
Well, certainly if there's federal and state funds mixed in, but first of all, that hasn't gone into effect yet.
Right.
If it goes into effect at all, it would be probably sometime after the election in November. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's kind of typical of the Trump administration of downplaying climate change. I think California's case, California is, you know, the gold standard for, particularly for dam design. And I think, and, you know, with the fights that California's had over things like auto emissions with the Trump administration, mm-hmm. I would think that the California would, you know, basically go on its own and design its infrastructure as it wants to, taking climate change into effect. You know, the problem with when the federal government does something, a lot of states just kind of follow suit.
Right.
California would not be one of those, but certainly some states would.
There was a study of the Oroville Dam in California, the tallest in the nation. It had a near failure, and it was attributed to human-caused warming. So I'm wondering, is that the thing that they'll look at, like, say, the failure in Midland last week in the future and try to determine what caused it, or what difference does it make in the long run?
With the Midland failure, mm-hmm. I think it's a combination because it's not just you know, the extreme rain and whether the extreme rain was, you know, you could see the fingerprints of climate change in it or not. It's also the sort of more pressing problem is that dams like the Edenville Dam, the one that collapsed, are just in bad shape and not built to handle you know, a major flooding event that might not be climate change related. So. If anything, I think the Edenville collapse will spur more. We've got to do something about these older dams. They're on private property, privately held. Where does the money come? And the money would be, you know, in the aggregate would be tens of billions of dollars.
Right.
Where does the money come to repair the dam, to fix it, to bring it up to standards, to face more flooding in a warming world? Interestingly, Edenville Dam had a hydropower generating plant on it. And so it was regulated by the Federal Emergency, Federal Electric Regulatory Commission, FERC. And FERC were the ones who said, your spillways are no good. We're going to shut you down. But the private owner didn't have the money to repair the spillways. So it was at the time of the collapse, that dam was in the process of would eventually be sold to a sort of quasi-governmental group that had $100 million, had lined up $100 million of funding to make the necessary repairs. But there's thousands of other dams around the country where who knows where the money would come to fix things.
Right, right, because they're privately held.
And, you know, it's not like a dam is a money-making operation.
Right.
I mean, you know, that dam made a little bit of money from generating electricity, but you know, most dams serve a purpose of flood control or, you know, providing water for ranchers or for farmland or whatever. It's not like a, you know, a big, there's not a lot of money behind dams, basically.
You wrote recently about hurricanes becoming stronger worldwide, too. And what's the prognosis for the U.S. and its shorelines?
Well, the prognosis is, you know, more intense hurricanes means potentially, if the hurricanes strike land, stronger winds, more rain. Stronger winds bring more storm surge, and that, in most cases, in most hurricanes, storm surge is really the big problem. And you know, as the climate changes, sea level rises, that raises when there's a storm surge. Storm surge is a little bit higher because sea level's higher. So the prognosis isn't good. I mean, the real question is whether we'll really see the change. I mean, you know, we had a couple of years ago, I think it was 2017, when we had four really powerful storms hit the U.S. and the Caribbean. That was very unusual. I mean, if we get sort of a general pattern where every year we get three or four big storms and most of those hit the United States, I mean, that's very costly. Mm-hmm. Right? The damage from those is in the billions of dollars. So it's a question of both intensity and strength, and also just almost luck, where these things end up, where they form, where they travel as they travel up through the Atlantic Ocean, and whether they hit the coast or not.
I think it was when I was reading your article about the hurricanes that I read that, and I was surprised to read that unless it's going to hit the U.S., they don't study the size of the hurricanes.
Well, they do. They just don't study them as much.
Okay.
You know, it's
yeah.
very costly to, I mean, hurricanes can be studied partly by satellite imagery,
yeah.
Which is easy and convenient and not that expensive. But to really get a sense of the hurricane structure and the wind speed, you have to fly through them with these hurricane hunter aircraft. And that's very expensive and risky. So they won't do it if they're certain that the storm is going to track off to the east and avoid the United States or avoid the Caribbean or avoid the Gulf of Mexico. So they don't get as much data on it, essentially. Any storm that looks like it's headed for the U.S., they'll deploy the Hurricane Hunter aircraft. They'll get a lot more data.
Well, Henry Fountain, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Sure. Pleasure to be here.
Henry Fountain covers the climate for the New York Times. He covered the rains that caused the dam failure in Michigan, in Midland, Michigan, near Midland, Michigan last week. Coming up, we're going to talk to a professor of engineering from the University of Michigan and also the director of the State Climate Office of Ohio about what prospects Ohio faces going forward. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Columbus rainfall in mid-May left the ground too saturated to absorb a record-smashing downfall last week that produced minor flooding along some waterways and near flood stages along others. Sewers overflowed, basements flooded. At the same time, a central Michigan dam collapsed, forcing a mass evacuation and threatening a nearby chemical plant. The latest national climate assessment in 2018 shows climate extremes will worsen with hotter, wetter conditions, wetter conditions, further eroding the country's bridges, water supply system, and power grid. Seth Geikema is a professor of engineering at the University of Michigan. He focuses on industrial and operations and civil and environmental. He's also is president of the International Society of Risk Analysis. Welcome to the show, Seth Geikema.
Thank you for having me.
Director of the State Climate Office of Ohio is Brian Mark. He joins us by Skype. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Brian, a group of health and climate officials wrote an open letter to the emergency preparedness officials on May 11th about the number one weather-related killer, which is heat. What prompted that letter?
Yeah, we just got concerned because, you know, when we did our climate adaptation plan for the city of Columbus, we realized that a lot of the danger is going to be in hot conditions where people are going to need to get cooled off. And the human physiology is such that even if you can get a little bit of cooling, you can avert some major disasters. But heat is a big killer. The problem with that is in COVID reality, we're trying to social distance. And a lot of these massive cooling infrastructural adaptations would require people to get together in close proximity. So we thought, you know, here we are on the track to become perhaps the warmest year Earth's seen and in our recorded history. So what do we do about that vis-a-vis our new impending pandemic warnings to keep people apart? So we just thought we'd want to raise this issue. There was a National Academy report that came out, or webinar, that sort of started to address this too. So we wanted to be coming out with that news at the same time.
And then 2020 on track to be the Earth's warmest year on record. How does that, you know, Seth Geikema, play out when it comes to engineering and risk analysis?
Well, there's lots of potential impacts of both hotter weather and more extreme weather on infrastructure, from power to water to roads. And we're getting a pretty good understanding of all of this, but you can imagine, for example, like your last guest was talking about, the potential increase in hurricane intensity or frequency mm-hmm. is going to have really large impacts on power systems along coastal areas. And some of the other potential impacts of this might be more extreme winter weather in some cases, which can lead to increased pipe breaks and potentially more health impacts in drinking water systems.
You know, I moderated a panel discussion several years ago on climate change, and one of the members of the panel was from the U.S. military. This is a huge concern for the nation writ large, isn't it, Seth?
Yes, it is a tremendous concern, especially in the context in which we have aging, underfunded infrastructure, and we're already struggling in some sectors of the infrastructure with day-to-day operations, and then we put on top of that the increased hazards from everything from storms to summer storms, winter storms, hurricanes, heat waves, and yes, it's a tremendous impact, and certainly the Navy in particular has been very concerned about their coastal facilities and their infrastructure.
You know, I was just talking with Henry Fountain, climate reporter for the New York Times, and he made the salient point that most of the 91,000 dams in this country are smaller, but they're also privately owned, Brian Mark. What about in Ohio? What sort of challenge does that pose when they're privately owned?
I think that's a great point, and it's a matter of trying to meet standards of resistance for waters of maybe unforeseen magnitude. A lot of times when we build dams, the engineering is sound, and we think about, well, what's the likelihood of a major event of a certain proportion? And the way we get that is by looking at real data from the past. The problem is we've entered a new reality where everything we're doing now is against a backdrop of a warmer atmosphere, where you get 7% more humidity in the air for every 1 degree warmer you get in the air itself. So things have changed. And so looking just back casting to get an idea to what that dam should look like is probably not the best way to go forward. And if it's a privately owned affair, we need to have standards of inspection and other things that I imagine have to supersede some of those private domains.
Is that tendency to look backwards, which makes complete sense 100 years ago, Seth Geikema, but is that changing when it comes to risk analysis? It doesn't seem to make any sense.
Yes, yeah, certainly within academic research, there are methods that allow us to not rely on the past to do design.
Uh-huh.
The challenge is getting those translated into the design codes for built infrastructure. So the methods exist, and people are continuing to improve them. But how do we get those translated into practice so that it's guiding design in the field?
Why is that a challenge?
Well, there's a certain inertia to change in these design standards.
Oh, the same old reason. Okay. But isn't that what you guys do, risk analysis?
Yeah, so in risk analysis, we're not looking at the past. We're trying to look forward and say, what mm-hmm. are the potential outcomes in the future, and what's the likelihood of those outcomes happening, be it a really large rainfall event like happened in Edenville, or a Category 5 storm where they don't usually see these, and then what would the impacts of those be? So we have the tools and techniques to do that, and we do these one-off studies and these sorts of things, but how do we now translate that into design practice is a challenge.
Is it just about building higher dams when it comes to dams?
Not necessarily. So there's some really interesting discussion going on about why that particular dam failed from a geotechnical standpoint. Yes, it overtopped, and that caused problems, but there potentially were some other design problems with that dam. And this is an ongoing discussion. We're not at conclusions yet, but there's a really interesting video going around of the dam failure and then discussions by geotechnical and hydraulic engineers, like Jeremy Bricker from Delft, looking at why might this thing have failed. It's, yes, higher helps, but there's also how do we design it?
When you consider the climate change, Brian Mark, for Ohio, you know, when we look at these kind of weather patterns that just affected us last week, it was Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, and Michigan. Is that typical?
Yeah, so what happened last week was, if you look at just the way the patterns of synoptic events piled up, we had this storm off the East Coast that sort of backed up the upper level low, so it made for this moisture to sort of hang out in this stalled front. And we just got this persistent rain, and then things intensified. So on top of that, we had these record falls. I measured in my backyard 4 inches of rain, which is outstanding in 24 hours. So that sort of flash flood can be typical. And you notice that it gets then isolated to where those rains were most intense. But the entire region is within this domain of what we're experiencing in terms of a wetter regime, which is soil moisture conditions. And this is actually, when we look at seasonal progressions, ever more acute in the spring and fall transition seasons.
Seth Geikemo, I just brought up the region, and I'm wondering if there are regional conversations going on about risk analysis when it comes to structural engineering.
Yes, to some extent. There's certainly the state climate assessments. I think that's a good example where we see a regional, in this level, a state level sort of activity. And there's certainly state level bodies that look at dams and bridges and these other things. But a more larger region, like we just heard, right? We've got this region where we often see similar weather patterns. And we're working on a project with Ohio State looking at the impacts of extreme weather on power outages. And again, we have to look at the whole region. We can't just look at one area, or we're going to be missing a lot of the data that would be helpful. So I think it's starting, but I think we need more of it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. At Seth Geikemo. He's a professor of engineering at the University of Michigan and president of the International Society of Risk Analysis. Also with us, Brian Mark. He's director of the State Climate Office of Ohio. We're talking about the intersection of climate change and our infrastructure, an aging infrastructure, by the way. There's about 91,000 dams in the United States. Most of them are privately owned. Many of them are small. But most of them rank around a D grade by the American Society of Civil Engineers. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The power grid is obviously a big concern, Seth Geikemo. What's the outlook for that? How much of it is, as far as our power-producing plants, how much do they depend on maintaining a certain infrastructure through this change?
There's certainly a very large dependency on that power infrastructure for delivering power, and that infrastructure, that the transmission and distribution in particular, is very susceptible to events that are linked to changing climate, and particularly extreme weather. Something like about 80% of the power outages in the U.S. are caused by damage to the distribution grid, the lower voltage part of the system that brings the power into your house. And that's where we're doing a lot of work with utilities, and other people are as well, to try to better predict the impacts of forecast weather and help support longer-term decision-making, so we can consider those sorts of things that might happen in the future, not just what we've seen in the past.
And is that a function of, or are you using that to design different infrastructure, or is it how you how they're responding to the extreme weather going forward? You know, deploying repairmen, for instance.
Well, a lot of utilities are interested in right now is better responding,
okay,
because that's something they can change more quickly. But there are utilities that are looking further ahead and saying, how do we design differently? How do we, if we look out 50 or 60 years, what might our weather patterns look like? And heat is a big problem for power systems in some part of the country, and they're thinking that through pretty carefully, particularly Southern California and some other places. And then in Florida, where they get lots of hurricanes, they have done some proactive things to try to harden their system, looking ahead 50 years and realizing this is going to get worse.
So looking ahead, Brian Mark, 50, 60 years, from where you sit in the State Climate Office of Ohio, what does it look like for Ohio?
It's looking warmer and wetter. And so the same trends that we've been discussing with a warmer atmosphere, we get more moisture. Humidity feedbacks are really important, of course, for the way we feel and experience that heat. But then also that right back, the cycle into the water cycle and the intensification of the rainfall. You know, we might see short-term benefits of longer growing periods, but those will likely be offset by the detrimental effects of that intensification and shift in seasonality and total rainfalls. So we need to ironically, perhaps, or, you know, be prepared for both more drought and more flooding. And I would say, Anne, that the climate world thinks a lot about regions. And so even the National Climate Assessment, which is mandated by federal law to come out every 4 years, looks at the Midwestern region. It does a nice job assessing what we know about the climate and what the projections look like in the future. And also our good friends up in Michigan, we're not all enemies in this region, are united around climate in the Great Lakes Integrated Science and Assessment, or GLESA. And then we also have a Midwestern Regional Climate Center, and the USDA has a Midwestern Climate Hub. So there's a lot of ways in which climate is looked at regionally. I think there's ways we could do it even better when we integrate the measurements we have on the ground to see how these things are changing.
Except, and here's the but question, is the Trump administration has proposed that climate change would not be need to taken into account when assessing the environmental impacts of major infrastructure. I did an entire show on that about a month ago. Seth Geikema, does that really make that much difference when they make those kinds of policy changes?
Well, potentially. We'll have to see when the changes are actually implemented relative to the election that's coming up and how that trickles down to processes and assessments in place for these federal projects. So it could, but I don't think we're there yet, at least not in a hard sense of this causes that. But it certainly sets the tone for those people doing the assessments that maybe you don't have to do that or do that as seriously as you might otherwise do it. Now, then there's still the private side and the state side, which is still a lot of projects.
Mm-hmm.
And those, there's other regulations that also affect that.
Yeah, and Brian Mark, thoughts about that?
Yeah, I am equally frustrated when we see that the messages are so mixed at different levels, because this is clearly an integrated system and the atmosphere doesn't stop at the boundary of states. I would just nod to the even local and municipal levels to see where there's real action, because I think that's where the rubber hits the road and people are realizing that there's important connections to be made between adaptation plans and infrastructure, and maybe prioritizing what the funds are available to actually make change happen and where you want to to your adaptation planning. So for example, again, back to the climate adaptation plan for Columbus, aging infrastructure was identified as one of the priority things we want to focus on. You know, how do we get ready for these larger flood and larger shifts between drought and flood in the city? And how do we want to be prepared for cooling centers for people that are most vulnerable in our populations?
Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi, I'm glad you just mentioned infrastructure.
Right.
Because here in Linden and over in Hilltop, they're going it's not enough just to install a sump pump, assuming that you're just going to have to pump away rainwater. These ancient sewage lines, sanitary sewer lines, have no backflow valves installed on them. And by the way, if you've ever priced out the equipment of what goes into a sump pump at your local big box store type place, that's going to run about $1,000, not including labor. If you call a qualified plumber here in Columbus and you're talking about an automatic backflow valve, you're talking about a $5,000 investment for the homeowner. And those have to be universally installed because the houses that don't have them will take all the backflow of the houses that do.
So Charlotte's bringing up sort of that micro-level adjustments. Seth Geikema, I mean, any thoughts about that?
Yes, a couple. So, one, aging infrastructure certainly is a tremendous problem that underlies a lot of this. And I think that's something that hopefully we can all agree that we need to do something about. We haven't figured out how yet entirely. But we've also done a lot of work looking at that individual household level and how people respond to a disruptive event from a hurricane to a flood can really affect the vulnerability of the community over the long term. That is, they make changes in their household. What does that do to that community over the long run? And there's things insurance can do here. There's things that local jurisdictions can do to try to, after events happen, make changes to the system. That is, take advantage of that disruption when things are disrupted or broken or flooded to go in and not just put it back the way it was before, but to do what we call bounce forward and try to improve the system so it's more resilient to future climate shocks.
Hmm. And Brian, Mark, are there going to be like the haves and the have-nots when we go forward with all of this? As I think Charlotte really described very well, is sure someone down the line can get the make the adjustments at the individual level, but what about the next door neighbor?
I think that's a really good point. And I, for myself, when we moved into our house about 4 years ago, our climate adaptation plan became much more concrete in the form of bigger gutters. We just couldn't afford to replace the roof with solar panels. So we decided to think about a longer term plan. But yeah, I mean, if we're left to this kind of local disaggregated response, it's really difficult to mobilize. And there will be people that will be able to thrive and afford to be more resilient than others. But we're all going to bear the consequences when the system falls apart and people, you know, like we're seeing now, when all of a sudden we have some other strange thing change and we have to totally alter the way we do our daily lives and exist. So it's a system that is vulnerable in many levels, and resilience means many different things.
I think of you, Seth Geikema, as more of a big bridge, dam, you know, power grid kind of a guy. But what about building specs for houses and things like that?
Yeah, so certainly those building standards do have a large influence on things like energy consumption, which are directly tied to climate change through emissions, of course, but also on things like wind resistance. So in hurricane-prone regions or in areas where you get derechos frequently, like the 2012 derecho in Columbus, certainly those wind resistance standards have a big effect. But one of the big ones at the local household level, if you are near a water body, is how we manage flood risk in the U.S. and the flood insurance program. Mm. And it is badly in need of an overhaul. And that's from the top down to the local household level. And that's something where individual homeowner decisions, where you build, how you build, has a tremendous influence on that risk over time. And I also just want to echo a point that I think you made, which was we also have to be really careful about the impacts of interventions we take, because we might create a case where we're helping one population and really hurting another population. And flooding, riverine flooding, is one of those. There's certain things we could do that could protect one area, make it much worse in a different area because of the hydraulics of the area. So we have to be very careful about how we do that.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about climate change. It's getting warmer and what the impact will be on our infrastructure going forward. You just heard from Seth Geikema. He's a professor of engineering at the University of Michigan and president of the International Society of Risk Analysis. Also with us is Brian Mark. He's director of the State Climate Office of Ohio. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about climate change and its effect on infrastructure and what is being done now to assess and offset the risks in the future. Still with us is Director of the State Climate Office of Ohio, Brian Mark. He joins us by Skype. He's a professor of geography at Ohio State. And Seth Geikema, he's a professor of engineering at the University of Michigan, and he is president of the International Society of Risk Analysis. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Brian Mark, there was a web conference held in April. It was titled Solve Climate by 2030. What were some of the highlights from those discussions that address infrastructure?
That was an interesting event, and it was started by a group at Bard College. And really, I think it was more intended to get a conversation going and to think, well, if we could boil this down to, you know, some priorities, what would they be? And infrastructure definitely got into the mix of the discussions, because when we start to think, okay, well, what makes sense to do, given that the whole backdrop of climate reality is different? And that's kind of the way we like to put it. You know, climate change is almost, you know, passé. If you think about it as a debatable point that's changed, it's not changed. It's already changing, and we're already in a new state. Mm-hmm. And so everything's different. This is a threat multiplier, is the best way to think about it. And so infrastructure is a practical, immediate concern. It's something that we know we need to address. We see it around us. We impact with it daily through our transportation, through our bridges and roads, and then the grid, of course, the way we get power. So it became a discussion where people targeted that amongst a number of different breakout groups that we had, because we had to do it virtually.
You know, Seth Geikema, I'm thinking kind of in a larger sense about how we create and build our infrastructure. And we've just been on this trend, it feels, especially in Central Ohio, for the last decade, of more concentration of people, building in the cities, rebuilding in the cities, getting people out of the suburbs and that kind of a thing. And now with the pandemic, we're rethinking that. More people are thinking, gosh, maybe I want to live in the suburbs because I don't want to be smashed in with a bunch of other people. How do you manage all the different layers of risk when you're planning infrastructure?
Well, it's certainly a challenge. And part of the challenge is that there are multiple agencies that each play a role, and they aren't necessarily fully coordinated. So you have the federal, the state, the local, and even at the local level, the water utility is a very different agency than your local electric power company. So there's a real challenge of a coordination problem there. And in many ways, that densification that has happened in a lot of places has been good from an environmental perspective. Mm-hmm. We've reduced emissions. We've reduced a lot of these problems. And it also is an opportunity, if we do it right from the infrastructure perspective, to take that 50, 60-year look forward and design differently. The challenge is we have such a large stock of existing infrastructure already, and it's very expensive to change that. So there needs to be a lot more coordination among these different agencies in terms of how they're designed and where things are built and how they're built. I think the water system is a good example. For quite a while, we installed the drinking water system with heavy federal subsidies, and then water was priced in a way that was based on providing water, not on maintaining the system. So now we have a vastly underfunded water system in most cities in the U.S., and in a sense, the bill is coming due, and we now have to figure out how do we deal with that. And this is a chance, I think, to really rebuild differently and in a way that's more attuned to the potential climate change and attuned to these other social changes that are happening in cities.
Does it feel like it could happen that could happen in Ohio, Brian Mark?
Yeah, I think it does. And one of the ways that we envision doing that process of integration is through the university. So, you know, the climate office is something that really got started by me as a kind of service part of my job as a professor. The title state climatologist was held for years by a former colleague of mine, but there's never been any federal funding since 1973 for these state level activities of climate. So we envision this to be an opportunity to take information that's out there, and get it in a form that's more usable to people to make these decisions. In other words, like if we're going to look at an infrastructural change, there's a huge amount of inertia, as Seth's been saying, and we need to inform that with an integration of models that look into the future, that take into account the changed, altered state of the atmosphere, and then redesign those curves of probability and therefore translate it to different action. But it has to be seen by multiple actors, and it has to be done kind of in an integrated way. And so we think trying to do that through the university now would be a great opportunity.
Why the funding drop off in 1973, Brian?
Good question. And it just became something where NOAA was under other stresses, and they decided they were going to no longer have this kind of money to dispense, and they left it up to the states to figure out what to do. In Ohio in 1977, the legislature recognized the Department of Geography and John Rayner, who was the chair at the time, as the acting state climatologist, to basically be the holder of the data. And really, there was never a perceived need to take that historic data and actually think more deliberately about the patterns that it was telling us for how to alter the view of the future. And so I think now that we have a different mandate ahead of us, that information stewardship, I think, has a different role of looking forward.
David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hello. Thank you very much. I know of no other topic that will end the human race. Our grandchildren may not live long. There's little time until the point of no return. It's going to take much time to educate the power structure, since facts don't seem to work. It's going to even take more time to infect, to do the major changes that are required. So how do we get organization and cooperation and action starting now? Exactly what needs to be done, since facts don't work? Thank you.
Thanks, David. You know, if my memory serves me correct, 73 is right around when the Nixon administration ended, Brian Mark.
I don't have quite the same memory of that. But
yeah. That's how old I am. But the Nixon administration, it was during that time that they created the EPA and that kind of a thing. And it's been sort of since they've been pushing more and more off to the states over the years.
Yep. And that's a good point. Like those important federal regulations on air quality and water quality came into being at that time, and mm-hmm. Now are being at risk of being overlooked by other interests. So I think, you know, we're in a state where there's disinformation actively, and there's this stymied response at the federal level. So, you know, real action and change, I think, has to start at the lower levels, where people are realizing the reality of climate and realizing the reality of adaptation strategies on multiple fronts and how these are all interrelated issues. I mean, let's face it, it's not just raising the temperature and changing the precipitation regime, but it's the flood runoff and the nutrients that go back into Lake Erie and cause algal blooms and endanger water supplies to Toledo. These are all interrelated concerns. Health is right around the corner. Like we're trying to warn people about heat and humidity. It really can be devastating to the human physiology. There are real thresholds to human health here. And you put that into the mix with the pandemic, we got a lot of issues that we have to deal with. And so, I don't have a good historical perspective on the political reality of defederalization, but I think in the reality that we're facing now, I think community has a new vibrancy that needs to be realized at the local level. We got to get together with our neighbors, regardless of their political perspective.
Tommy, Seth Geigema?
Well, I was just going to say, we certainly need more coordinated action, but I'm also encouraged, I work a lot with utilities, and I'm encouraged that they're taking action on their own in many cases, mm-hmm. but we need to right-size or correct our regulations, depending on how you want to put it, so they're not getting in the way of that.
Interesting. Okay. Tommy in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Tommy.
Yeah, hi. Good, fascinating program, but anyway... is there ever a situation where something that wasn't a floodplain before, but because of climate change, it is now? And then if so, how often and when is something like that evaluated?
That's an interesting question. I mean, are we making, are those kinds of adjustments being made, Seth Geikema, and do they matter?
Yes, we are redoing our floodplain maps, we collectively, the federal government, and it takes into account a lot of different things. Some of it is just infrastructure development. So if you build a new bridge, it changes the floodplain if you've got abutments and things like that, and correcting some other things that have happened in the past. But what they're not doing that I'm aware of is looking forward 50 years and say, what will be in the floodplain in that future 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 40 years from now? It's more correcting based on what we've seen to date, accounting for both development and changes in precipitation. Now, it's a slow process to update all those floodplain maps. It's not done, but they're working on it.
Okay, but Tommy, thanks for that question. And then one last question from Mary in Columbus. Hi, Mary.
Hi. What might it take to provoke the property casualty insurance industry to aggressively start denying insurance to new building projects that are obviously now at much higher risk from climate change?
Seth Geikema, is that part of the equation?
Well, in Florida, after a series of particularly bad storms in the early 90s, they got to the point where it was very, very hard to get homeowners insurance. So that did have substantial impacts. Now, that also impacts people who are already there. In terms of denying coverage to people who choose to build in a particularly high-risk area, it's an interesting thing that's been discussed, particularly in the light of flooding. But with the current structure of the program, there's a lot of challenges to putting that in place.
It's just, you mean the way
the National Flood Insurance Program is currently operated.
All right, Mary, thanks a lot for that call. You know, Seth Geikema, you use game theory in your risk analysis methods. How does that work?
So game theory is when you're modeling the interactions of multiple entities. So we've used it to look at the interaction between multiple infrastructure owners, for example, a power system and a water system. And if you're trying to improve the infrastructure in an area, if those two aren't coordinated, that can cause a lot of friction and waste a lot of resources. So is there a way we can set policies and incentives to get different players coordinated so that they're trying to achieve the same thing rather than going in their own direction and causing problems for each other?
And does it, you know, what do you learn from that? I mean, give me an example of how that's helped.
Well, just a really simple example. We're working with one particular utility. We're working with a water utility, and they knew they had a large 52-inch main that they needed to urgently do maintenance on. But they also knew in 3 years the local communications company was going to rip up the road and put in new cable, and then there was a plan, and a couple of years after that, it was going to be ripped up again to put in new power lines. So can we create a way that provides an incentive them to do it all at the same time so we don't rip up the same road three times to fix three different buried infrastructures underneath it? That's a very simple local example, but then you can look at kind of broader picture. Can you operate a water system in a way that's more aware of the impacts on the power system?
Uh-huh.
We've got these big pumps and all this sort of stuff. Can we coordinate across these infrastructures to reduce costs or reduce environmental burdens of operating these things?
It's the issue of coordination comes up a lot, as you've made clear. Seth Geikema, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Seth Geikema is a professor of engineering at the University of Michigan. He's president of the International Society of Risk Analysis. Brian Mark, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's great to be with you.
Brian Mark is director of the State Climate Office of Ohio. That's it for this hour. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.